You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
In 1917, four seismic shocks rocked the human species. In Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution brought a specter from Europe into the center of the world's most expansive land empire. In Europe, an armistice ended the Great War. Around the world, a pandemic virus began to kill its millions. And in America, the first jazz recording became available. Communism and viruses and jazz had been around before then, of course. But history tells stories with sources, so here we are. 108 years later, the span between the Chicago Cubs World Series wins, the Reverend William Carter is here to join us and talk about the spirituality of it all. Okay, mainly of jazz. His book, Thriving on a Riff, from Broadleaf Books, meditates on spiritual matters with one hand and on the Bible with the other. And Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to welcome him to the show. Bill, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, among other things, this is a book of stories, so start us off with one. What was Louis Armstrong doing in Oil City, Pennsylvania in 1955, and what's your personal connection with that show?
Well, he was playing a concert for my mother and over 1,000 other people, Northwestern Pennsylvania on, a Thursday night. So obviously he was going between two places, probably State College, Pennsylvania, and Cleveland. So my mother was asked, it was the around the time of her 19th birthday, her aunt said, "Shall let's go." They paid $1.85 for a ticket, sat in the balcony, and she said, "This was unbelievable." And I said, "Well, what was unbelievable about it?" She said, "Well, two things. One, within 30 seconds, Armstrong was reaching on the top of the piano, grabbing a handkerchief, fresh handkerchief, wiping his brow and dropping it to the ground. He was that immersed in the music. And the second thing was that the room changed." And I said, "How did it change?" And she said, "We all felt so good." And that story was kind of a family story. When I was working on the book, she actually reached into a scrapbook and pulled out the ticket and gave it to me. It's now framed in my studio. And I've been able to mine it because it really intersects with a lot of the issues of jazz in America. Everything from its origin as entertainment music, its development as an art form, the interplay between the music and its improvisation. You know, these guys came out with the band, had no sheet music in front of them, just played. And they hadn't simply memorized the parts, they were inventing some of the parts. They had a standard repertoire that they had drew on, but also the interplay with jazz and race in America. The town was not officially a sundown town, but we have it on good authority that Mr. Armstrong would not have been able to find a place to stay in that little Western Pennsylvania town that night. He'd have to travel somewhere else. And yet here he was playing for a largely Scots-Irish white crowd and lifting their spirits and transforming the room.
Very good. Well, listeners, now you have a sense of the kind of stories that provide occasion for spiritual reflection throughout the book. And Bill, I do want to ask about the book as a whole. Is this a devotional, an Ignatian exercise manual, something else? When our listeners pick this book up, what are they getting ready to read?
Well, it's like jazz in that it's open to the interpretation of the person who hears it or reads it or enters into it. What I've tried to do is find the linkages between the spiritual life, as I conceive of it, and this musical tradition of 120 some years. And I didn't want to talk about spirituality because I don't know what that word means.
I don't either, so I'm glad you said that.
It's a vapor in the air, and sometimes it's lighting a candle and dimming the lights and listening to a drone on a log drum or something. But what matters to me is the spiritual life, how a life might be formed and transformed by practices, and particularly how the spiritual life for each of us might be shaped by the music we listen to. And I've been shaped by the jazz tradition, both as a musician and as a listener. And the more I dug into that issue, the more I discovered. So it's everything. It's biblical interpretation of sacred texts, because jazz plays texts that might be composed, and yet it doesn't end with that. It spins them into the air. It has to do with human creativity and its origin in divine creativity. It has to do with the building and disruption and rebuilding of communities. It has to do with our hope. It can't mask our brokenness. And then it also points to our healing and possibly our final redemption. So all of this is there, and it's all present in the stories of these great musicians, but also a whole lot of reflection that glues them all together.
All right. Well, one of the common, I'm going to call it structures in this book, is that the stories from the music world lead to reflections on biblical narratives or theological images or other things that one associates with church. So let's talk about a few of them, and let's start with the ways that interpretation and invention and preparation relate to each other. So what do we learn about the spiritual life when a bunch of preachers get together in Preservation Hall in New Orleans?
We've learned that if all they're doing is keeping their nose in the crook of a book, they're missing out on a whole lot, that there's a whole hidden vitality and animation that happens. My friend Ched Myers, who's a theologian and activist.
I've read a couple of his books.
Yeah, on the West Coast, speaks about theological activation. You know, it's one thing to have an idea or to read a text. It's another thing to actually engage in doing something about it, particularly for the benefit of other people. So I went with a bunch of preachers, and we ended up actually two nights in a row at Preservation Hall. And it was great. Shannon Powell, who played with Wynton Marsalis, was playing drums. He was talking to a guy in a yellow suit and a yellow hat. Turned out it was Cyril Neville of the Neville Brothers, who sat in playing a woodblock. And they started playing church hymns, and they were not like anything we'd ever heard. And, you know, just to mind that experience, you're starting with something that everybody knows or everybody shares as a common text of sorts, but then it's lifted up and communally discussed musically. That's what a lot of jazz improvisation is. It's a conversation around the source material. And when I think about it, you know, my day gig, I'm a preacher. I've been doing this for 40 years as a Presbyterian minister. And that's exactly what happens in the sermon too. You're delving into something that existed before you. You're listening to it, you're listening to those around you, and you're daring to try to put something into the air. It's a sonic experience that will offer some insight. You know, and I think that's not a bad way to think about interpreting a text, a literary text. Mm-hmm. It honors the creative disciplines of the interpreters. And that is something that requires the preparation. A jazz musician works on scales and harmony and a lot of listening to other musicians. That's what we do. I have some piano students who want to learn jazz, but they've never listened to it. And I said, okay, you come back after you spent 40 hours listening to Oscar Peterson and Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea and Keith Jarrett, James P. Johnson and Fats Waller, and, you know, just take the whole gamut, and the tradition will begin to shape you. And one of the ways it shapes you is that it opens up what's possible for its own future. Mm-hmm. You know, a tradition has its own future, which is extraordinary to me. You know, we're not running an antique show. We're not curating a museum. We're standing on the steps of those places and we are trying something new.
Right. Now, Bill, I've read and I've heard a fair number of people over the years call into question conventional boundaries between the sacred and the profane, but most of them don't involve Bobby McFerrin and the Gospel of Matthew. So leave our listeners some to discover when they go out and get your book, but tell us why they'll want to read about that strange pairing.
Well, so Bobby McFerrin, the Grammy Award-winning singer, the Don't Worry, Be Happy guy, actually based that number one hit on a reflection on the Sermon on the Mount from the Gospel of Matthew. He went into the studio, sang all the parts a cappella, overdubbed himself, and never thought he'd be making enough money to send his kids off to private Quaker schools in Philadelphia, you know, and get offers to go, you know, on movies and such, largely of which he has eschewed and said, no, that's, I'm not part of the star machine. I'm a musician. I got to meet him and sing with him on two different occasions, weekend gatherings on the Hudson River at a conference center. And one day we found ourselves walking along the same path. And he looked at me and said, "Preacher Bill, what are you reading these days?" "I'm reading the Psalms." And I said, "Well, I'm reading the Psalms." I said, "How about you?" And he said, "I'm working an inch at a time through the Gospel of Matthew." I mean, so here's, you know, you wouldn't know this by reading his, you know, bio or his press reports or anything like that, but he's a profoundly spiritual man. And we found in the brief friendship we built that he actually thought about going and joining an Episcopalian monastery when he was a teenager. He loves the quiet. He loves the meditation. He loves the reflection. And it's out of that deep reservoir that he creates. So I mean, if that doesn't bridge the sacred and secular boundary, I don't know. And for me, it pushes into question whether there is a boundary. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're going to tell the holy where not to show up. You know, if they can play church hymns in Preservation Hall off of Bourbon Street, and most of the guys playing that night grew up in the church playing music. You know, I think jazz gets too quickly dismissed as secular by people who judge it or who bring their own narrow categories to it. And one of the purposes of this book was just to kind of blow that open and say, yeah, well, what about this? What about the fact that these are human beings who are gifted, who are collaborating, who are creating in motion, and they're changing and transforming the rooms that they're playing in?
Another common claim in books with spiritual in the title is that churches have failed to do what they're supposed to do, and something else, in this book, that something else is jazz, does what churches are supposed to do. So I'll go ahead and admit that such claims often make me suspicious. When I find out what these writers and speakers think church is supposed to do, I often find that our disagreement lies in that major premise before we ever get to the minor premise details. But you're my guest here, so I'll let you make your case and I'll listen. What are churches supposed to be doing, and how does jazz do that when churches fail to?
I think churches, first of all, are spiritual communities, and they need to renew that spiritual sense of their community. And if they don't, they become wonderful country clubs, curators of their own museums. But there ought to be something alive at the center of that. Call it spirit, call it Jesus, call it God, call it the holy, whatever we call it. And I think the church nurtures that, both in its teaching and its activity. And its activity needs to be both inside and outside the building, and maybe without a building at all. There ought to be, in the community where that community is settled, that there ought to be kind of a sense where if that church or synagogue or temple was missing, that people would actually miss it, because mm-hmm. they know it's there to enrich their lives. And the point on to point the community to what's holy and true, to counter the lies and distortions that get thrown at us every day, and to find ways to step over the artificial humanity, the artificial boundaries of humanity, to build a deeper sense of belonging to one another. And do these churches succeed or fall? I think everyone falls. I really do. The churches that St. Paul wrote to, they don't exist anymore. But there was a moment, an intersection in time, when something was alive there, and something created a fresh life, where something spoke truth, where something witnessed to comfort and consolation and healing. You know, it kind of blows my mind when I was writing the book and exploring some of the points where people have had difficulties. I came across this story where Jimmy Green, the saxophonist for Harry Connick Jr., mm-hmm. lost his 5-year-old girl in the 2012 shooting in Connecticut in the school. And one of the most powerful parts of that story is that the jazz musicians who befriended him started knocking on his door, some of them coming to pray with him, just looking in on him. And that Jimmy and his wife have created the foundation to confront gun violence and to say that this is not anything that is life-giving. It's life-killing. And that they've committed themselves to this, and Jimmy does this also through music. You know, there isn't a more positive spirit than that big guy and his little horn and what he mm-hmm. does. And so part of my image for what churches or a spiritual community can do is to build on that, and to honor that, and to point to that and say, that's holy, right, and true. Mm-hmm. Which is a lot different from, you know, bickering in the church kitchen about whether or not to use Sanka or Fresh Brewed, or whether to get the cookies from Sam's Club because they're cheaper, or, you know, there's mm-hmm. all that stuff that devolves when institutional life takes over and kind of squelches the vitality.
All right. Well, when I saw that the book had a chapter on creativity and imagination as concepts, I honestly thought I was in for a sentimental and romantic notion of art as truly human and the elevation of imagination as the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And it had some of that, but this chapter surprised me a bit mm-hmm. when you wrote that imagination can bring life into dead places, but it can also make parasites out of people. Mm-hmm. So tell us a jazz story about parasites.
Oh, well, in the 1940s and 1950s, and I've continued the research after the book was written, mm-hmm. in the 1940s and 1950s, the jazz world was flooded by cheap heroin.
Yes.
It was thanks to gangsters who thought they could make a quick buck, particularly on African-Americans who were underpaid and living in difficult situations. So the jazz musicians, of course, who traveled all the time, were lonely, struggled to have productive family lives, never got enough money. But some of them became hooked and were enslaved by this powder. What Charles Lloyd called tragic magic. Mm-hmm. Kind of a poignant phrase. And some of them could create even in the thick of that. Charlie Parker was one of like the icons, and he would tell the younger musicians, don't do what I do off the bandstand. But they all, many thought, if I shoot up or take this pill or that powder, I'll have that kind of creativity. It's, you know, the addiction is a painful reality for many, many people. And it comes in many sinister ways. And one of the ways it's so sinister is it promises something it partially delivers, which is concentration and focus, mm-hmm. freedom. But it also enslaves and robs people of a lot of years. It breaks up families. It nurtures crime and criminal intent. So it's, you know, and to think that human creativity could be used for those purposes, you know, or that human creativity can be used by sending a bunch of guys to a flight school and then teaching them about architecture so that they could fly a plane into a building and knock it to the ground. I mean, those guys knew exactly what they were doing. And what an abuse of human capacity. So there needs to be kind of a stewardship of right and wrong, a morality, constructive decisions about what are we going to do with this ability that we have? Is it for good or is it for destruction? And that those are themes that spin off in the jazz tradition in 100 different people in 100 different ways.
Right. It's interesting. I've talked with friends who struggle with depression, and we often have that same conversation about, you know, sort of the stereotype of the depressed poet who, you know, has these great wells of creativity emerging out of that depression. And, you know, what a couple of them on different occasions have told me is that whatever depression is, it's not a well of creativity. I mean, you know, people might be creative irrespective of that, but it's not from the depression that the creativity emerges.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, there have been recent studies in the last 5 or 10 years about brain activity and creativity. You know, they'll put earphones on a jazz musician, pop that person in a CT scan or something, and then have them improvise, and then watch happens where the brain lights up. And it'll be fascinating in the years to come to see where the lines are, where the connections are.
Right.
Pat Metheny, the great guitarist, has done presentations with Charles Lim, who is a brain scientist. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating. And similarly, I'm reading right now, finishing up a Robin Kelly's biography of Thelonious Monk.
Okay.
And that creative man suffered with all kinds of mental health issues later in his life. And it's, you know, it's worth pondering. So where did his new angular melodies and harmonies arise from?
Right.
You know, they didn't come from the drugs. They came from some other place.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Charles Lloyd earlier, and I'll confess that although I enjoy listening to jazz records and have a fairly good working knowledge of jazz history, I had not heard of Charles Lloyd. So talk a little bit about his disappearance and his reemergence and what that story can tell us about the life of the spirit.
Okay. Charles Lloyd is a fascinating guy, still with us, living out near Santa Barbara, California. And he had played with Cannonball Adderley in the early 60s. He played with Gabor Szabo and others in the early 60s, and then struck up his own group. And he hired Keith Jarrett, who was in his early 20s, to play piano. And was extraordinary. He hit it at a time when jazz was on the decline socially and economically in America, early 60s. The Beatles were coming across the pond. The rhythms were changing. The instrumentation would change. And he took these songs, wrote these songs, and many of them almost folk songs, and just kind of spun them a certain way. And pretty soon he was playing in rock venues like the Fillmore, and he was going on huge festival circuits. sometimes where everybody else was a rock and roller, and Charles Lloyd comes out with this band, and self-consciously psychedelic, and they really flowered for about 3 years, and they toured the Soviet Union. They were all over Europe. They did huge things and a lot of power and a lot of wildness. Jarrett says that he got kicked out of Berklee School of Music because a professor walked in and he was reaching over in a jam session and plucking the strings on the inside of a grand piano. And, so he got tossed, and pretty soon he was doing the same thing with Charles Lloyd and doing it profoundly musically. And people were just reacting to this motion and creativity. Well, the whole situation blew up. A couple reasons. One, as I've been able to find out, was as their star began to rise and the rates of pay got higher, the rates of payment for the three other guys in the quartet did not get higher.
Ooh.
Whoops. Yeah. And someone handed the check to the bass player to pay for the gig, and it was significantly more than $100 he was making for that gig.
Right.
So there was, you know, classic old, you've moved from musician to entrepreneur, and you know that does affect the affection within the band, because they all talk. They all talk to one another. The other thing that Charles admits is that he had gotten involved in some kind of unsavory business himself, probably an addiction of some kind, and just all of a sudden just quit. He left. He ended up in Big Sur, California. He was growing vegetables, and as he says in one of his documentary interviews, he was pulling out the weeds, and I'm not talking about only the garden.
Right.
So he was kind of straightening out, got deep into kind of an Indian tradition of spirituality and deep meditation and devotion. And it was somewhere, I think, in the early 80s, a French pianist, young French pianist named Michel Petrucciani, found him, knocked on his door, and their friendship led to renewed playing, performances, record contract with ECM Records. And that has continued to evolve as Charles keeps playing extremely passionate music. He had one of his bands went into the studio shortly around the time of 9/11. And they're all kind of looking at one another. And Charles said, you know, we have a privilege here of creating beauty in the wreckage of all that ugliness. And so he perceived the jazz as a form of offering healing or transformation, first by recognizing the sadness that everybody felt, but also trying to construct something out of the ashes and the brokenness of that experience. Which was a model that kind of paralleled his own personal journey. I've never met him. I've never had the chance to hear him live. I have a lot of his recordings. I just deeply respect what he has done and continues to do with his life.
Well, one of the albums you write about that I have spent some time with is John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. So I recognized a fair bit of what you wrote about prayer and this album's unforgettable chants and riffs. So what do you invite your readers to consider about prayer when you reflect on A Love Supreme?
Well, start with this. Does prayer need words? Mm-hmm. Can you pray with tones? Can you pray with silences? Can you pray with a drum or a saxophone? And, you know, a lot of it has to do with how you direct or orient that activity. Are you sinking into something or someone greater than yourself? Are you offering what's most passionate in your soul to something outside of yourself? Are you anchoring your being in a mercy or a grace greater than what you can manufacture? I mean, no one ever sees God. That's not how it works. But that does not mean that God doesn't exist. It just means you can't see God. And so, Frederick Buechner, the great writer, used to talk about prayer is firing arrows out into the unknown. And so it's expression. And there's just a short distance between expression and art, or expression and music. And it's a way of cleansing what's within us, what's jumbled up, maybe even reorganizing, but it's also a way, I think, to connect to the great, humanistic value. Where does it come from? What can we do with it? And for Coltrane, this was part of his journey. He was the grandchild of two AME Zion preachers, not widely known. And his path took him through Christianity, but even beyond it. He was looking for a universal sound or a universal offering that would connect every soul. And so his liner notes of the A Love Supreme is one expression of that. It's like a free verse poem or free verse prayer. A lot of folks don't know that when you listen to that fourth movement of A Love Supreme, he's voicing those words on his saxophone.
Okay.
Which was discovered by Lewis Porter, one of his biographers. At first didn't know how that all connected, but in Porter's book about Coltrane, he's able to kind of take the transcription of the notes and assign the words to them. And this was Coltrane's personal devotional exercise, which he did not repeat when he played the piece in public a few more times. He changed it up. But for the album, there's kind of the assumption that maybe he had the poem on the music stand and he just told McCoy Tyner on the piano, play a C minor chord, and Jimmy Garrison on the bass, just strum a C minor chord, and Elvin Jones, just give me some backing on percussion. Mm-hmm. And he offers this up. It's powerful if you don't know the words. It doubles its punch if you try to follow the words along with text. And it's a kind of an open and accessible, almost universal prayer. It's not Christian or Jewish or Sufi or anything particularly. It just is what it is, an expression of a soul transcending himself, which I didn't know the first time I listened to the album. First time I got that album and put it on, I remember my mother saying, "Hey, would you turn that down?
Yeah,
it's a little too intense."
Mm-hmm. Yep. Jazz, like many art forms that emerge from places and moments that aren't at the center of an empire, has some mixed origin stories. So we can talk about the first extant jazz recording from 1917, but before that, things get murky. So what about these obscure origins is significant for thinking about the spiritual life?
Okay. Well, it's like trying to figure out if there was an Adam and Eve and where they were. and the origin is obscured to us. I think it's true for jazz as well. And that's okay. That's okay, because if we could figure out what two test tubes were compared and combined to turn into this bubbling stew of music, then we think we could master it.
Mm-hmm.
But it can't be mastered. It's too elusive. And I think that's the truth also about the spiritual life. You know, where does it come from? You can keep exploring, But it, I think that's missing the larger issue, which is how can I be part of this and how can it be part of me? So in terms of jazz origins, it bubbles up in the gumbo of different impulses. One is the impulse of all these folks gathering in the port town of New Orleans after after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And there are leftover band instruments lying around or available for relatively inexpensive cost. And street bands begin to play, and they're all learning to play by rote and showing one another what valve to push or what slide to put out. And they're doing this cross-culturally, largely. Jazz is not specifically African-American, and it certainly isn't Anglo or European. It's what happens when you take the tempered scale of Germany and add the blue notes of those suffering under the oppression of slavery, and watching what emerges. Certainly the early practitioners were almost exclusively African-American, or like Jelly Roll Morton, they were Creole, blending of traditions. But it's an illusion to say it only began in New Orleans. There was music bubbling up in New York, in Charleston, South Carolina, and upstream in Chicago. Scott Joplin was syncopating marches and turning them into ragtime pieces in Sedalia and St. Louis. You know, there were just these little pockets. And so one of the writers I discovered says that it wasn't a single flame, it was more a candelabra. And that it happened for some reason around that time. But there are two other influences that kind of I write about a bit. One is the Pentecostal influence about the time that Duke Ellington was starting his piano lessons with a teacher named Mrs. Clink Scales, of all things. There was this revival happening in Azusa Street in Southern California, people breaking out, speaking in tongues, forging communities that were across racial and economic boundaries. They were energized by some spiritual presence. And of course that blew up when money got to be part of the equation, kind of like the Charles Lloyd Band. But the other piece I discovered was that on the East Coast, there were people settling from Scotland because of economic deprivation there. And they were landing in, say, Cape Fear, North Carolina, mm-hmm. and creating farms that became plantations. And then, shall we say, euphemistically, of importing cheap labor from Africa. Mm-hmm. And then finding, you know, they had some responsibility to teach these African folks some gospel. So they built double-decker churches, which still exist. And the darker skinned folks came in the back door where they wouldn't be seen. And the white folks are down below are chanting out the Psalms in Gaelic. And next thing you know, there's a cross-fertilization of the two cultures, because the Psalms would be sung call and response. And that's how music functioned in Africa. Someone would be lining out a line and the rest would echo it back. Next thing you know, you've got this musical miracle happening. And during Reconstruction, a lot of the folks whose forebears grew up in Africa moved down toward the Delta. And there's a strong connection between early rhythm and blues, early jazz, early gospel music, done the same way the Psalms were done in Scotland, of all places. Mm-hmm. Different. And folks can read about what I've discovered in the book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
It just crazy stories like this, Nathan, you know, of folks encountering one another, and then the sparks kind of fly between them.
Right. Now, if our listeners under 40 have had any encounters with jazz, they might have studied Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit in school. It's become a staple in high school English textbooks.
Wow.
And it's become a standard for exploring protest art. So what kinds of connections will readers find between protest and spirituality and jazz in this book?
In this book. Well, in a chapter that deals with the racial issues of America and America's music, they'll find that there were three key figures, at least. Billie Holiday, of course, who discovers mm-hmm. the poem by Lewis Allen, and somehow that's set to music. I'm not sure who takes credit for that. But she had it set up that she would sing this song about black bodies swinging in the breeze, hanging from the poplar trees. It's the last song she would do on Spotlight, nothing to follow. The lights would go out and she would step off stage. Mm-hmm. And some of the white hierarchy, just they had profound issues with that. And then you can read about that in the book. But that was her protest. And that song was selected as the number one song of the 20th century by Time Magazine, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Strange Fruit. It's a terrible, awful.
And honestly, I think that song might have been the genesis of its migration into high school English textbooks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a great entree into exploring racism. And mm-hmm. sung by this wonderful broken voice, this woman who was handcuffed to a hospital bed, dying of cirrhosis and having heroin planted on her by the narcs. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are injustices all over the place there. But also Charles Mingus protested the racism that he encountered all the time as a person of mixed race. Wrote a piece called Fables of Faubus, mm-hmm. After Governor Faubus of Arkansas, taking him on for his denial of the Supreme Court decisions allowing everybody to go to school in the same room. And then my hero, and actually my friend, is the late Dave Brubeck, mm-hmm. who made business decisions based on having an interracial band. And the business decisions were this: we're going to hire the best musicians we can for our quartet, period. And in one really sobering moment, he got called to do one of the greatest possible exposure gigs, publicity gigs. He was on a major television station in New York, and he shows up with his quartet, including his African-American bass player, Eugene Wright, and they wanted him to play behind the curtain. They're just going to show the white guys, the three white guys on camera, and Dave said, no, we've had enough of this, and he walked off. Just walked off. Mm-hmm. He figured the station could find somebody else. And, you know, he got death threats for it. And he had cancellations of concerts when they discovered he wouldn't change his band to meet the racist demands of the places where they were playing. But that kind of integrity emerges in friendship and the friendships that transcend race. And they're based on the common experiences of making music together. Hmm. And, you know, God bless those people who are still befriending those unlike them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my brother's in the comedy scene out in Los Angeles, and that's something that he talks about a fair bit, is that you know, in a city where, you know, people based on their partisan loyalties won't associate with each other, he says that in the comedy clubs, you know, and I'll confess this makes me a little bit uncomfortable, but, you know, guys who are affiliated with the Proud Boys will hang out with, you know, very dedicated progressive Democrats, and yeah. You know, after they do their sets, they have drinks together, and, you know, they call each other idiots, as you would expect, but, you know, that's what my brother, you know, has told me about the comedy scene. It's one of the last places where, people who will not, you know, who will not eat with sinners will eat with sinners.
Yeah. And you know, you have to wonder, like, so what's that about? And where did we lose our common humanity? What has fractured that? You know, those little, once in a while, those memes or pictures that show up of kids of different races playing together on the playground.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we, as the Broadway show said, you've got to be carefully taught racism. You've got to be carefully taught.
Carefully taught to hate. I was actually in the pit orchestra for South Pacific.
Yeah. I mean, it's powerful. It's powerful.
Yeah. Well, another figure that I had not heard before your book is Juan Genzel. And unless I read it wrong, he's not mainly known for being a musician, but for someone who, in your stories, hangs out with musicians. So tell Genzel's story and talk to us a little bit about the hang. What is the hang after the set is over?
Well, the hang is the musicians hanging out together. It's in the church world, we call it fellowship or koinonia, but it's basically, well, at its heart, it's a new form of friendship. Juan Genzel, or John Garcia Genzel, was born in Puerto Rico, was sent to the States by his family, where he landed about an hour southwest of where I live in northern Pennsylvania. And one night he went to hear a band in a pavilion. It was the famous Duke Ellington Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And it blew his circuits. It blew his circuits. I was able to find actually the playbill from that concert, which again was probably on an off night, because the bands would often play weekends in the major city and then move out to travel during the week and find whatever they could. So he's in Berwick, Pennsylvania. He hears this band and he never forgets it. So he does a stint, I think, in the Navy, and he is stationed in New York, and he starts hitting these jazz clubs and loving it, and feels a call to go into the ministry. He's a Lutheran, so, and he gone to Susquehanna University and gone the ordination track. And he starts showing up after that in these nightclubs wearing his clergy collar. And it, at first people were kind of suspicious, you know, like, what, who's the priest? Who's that guy? And then from what I hear of it, the musicians would peel off from the others, and one would go over and say, you know, I'm having trouble with my family. My old lady's, you know, she doesn't like me doing what I'm doing. And, you know, I'm just, could we talk some time? And Genzel, just to honor these musicians, he would have conversations, pastoral conversations, listen to them, counsel them, encourage them. You know, another might come and say, hey, I want to get married. Can you do the wedding? Or, hey, we just had a baby. Would you baptize or christen the baby? And next thing you know, he's like well-known and well-trusted by most of the jazz community. And in time, he lands a ministerial gig, so to speak, as a chaplain to the night flock, as he called it. And out of St. Peter's Lutheran Church, which is still at 54th and Lexington in New York City. In fact, they sold the building rights to a Citicorps and created an endowment, and then in turn built a sanctuary actually underground, one floor underground. And ever since, somewhere around 65 or so, John Genzel created a Sunday early evening jazz vespers, and he would invite the musicians to play. Didn't need much of a budget. They just needed a place to play, kind of built a little liturgy or service around it. And it took off, and it became like the jazz church. It's still going on. They have a columbarium in the back of the sanctuary, you know, niches for people's cremains, you know. Joe Newman is there. Other musicians are there. John Coltrane's funeral was there.
Right.
just extraordinary outreach and connection with the jazz community. And Ellington wrote a piece in one of his sacred concerts called Shepherd of the Night Flock in honor of John Gensel. Hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to talk about another jazz church service, because I usually associate the name Vince Guaraldi with Charlie Brown's Christmas Special. And honestly, I usually don't spend much time thinking about him unless it's December. So talk to our listeners for a moment about his work with jazz and churches.
Oh, it's another crazy story. And for a while, there's more legend than truth. So I was able to kind of get at the heart of it. Guaraldi was kind of playing around the clubs, mostly in San Francisco and the Bay Area, and had hit it big, kind of a quirky song called Cast Your Fate to the Winds. And it was quite the tune on AM radio. It was long before FM. And one day, there was a guy by the name of Bill Melendez who was driving across the Golden Gate Bridge and heard the tune on the radio. And he thought, well, that'd be kind of cool. You know, we're talking about an animated special with Charles Schulz and Peanuts. And so let's do that. And got in touch. And actually, the animated special, they couldn't sell it. Didn't work. The music was fine, but for some reason, no one wanted to buy it. About the same time, there was an Episcopalian priest named Charles Gumperts, Chuck Gumperts. And Chuck, a young firebrand, really involved in civil rights, he saw in the newspaper some mention of Bishop Pike of San Francisco was going to have all these events celebrating the creation of an opening of Grace Cathedral, massive stone cathedral in Nob Hill of San Francisco. That was going to be in the kind of the spring of 65. And so he said, we're going to have a holy hootenanny, or that was reported. Well, Father Gumperts calls up the bishop's office, actually gets the bishop on the phone and says, Bishop, I just have to say, you know, that's just not proper. You know, we shouldn't be calling this a hootenanny. I mean, it's a celebrative moment, you know. And the bishop said, fine. It's now your event. Fill the cathedral in May of 65, and hung up the phone. And Chuck says, I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be sent to the little dinky churches for the rest of my career. I have just ruined it by mouthing off to the bishop. So in a Charlie Brown moment of sorts, he drew a bath and he sat in the bath. And while he's in the bathtub, he hears Cast Your Fate to the Wind. He calls out his wife and says, what's that song? And she finds out, and she tells him the thing. He says, well, that's what I've just done. And then it hits him. What if we did a jazz mass? So he finds Guaraldi. They have lunch. And Guaraldi says, well, sure, you know, Bach, Mozart, they've created masses. Why can't I? A little bit of hubris. And so it develops. And it was a sellout. It was huge. They brought in Malcolm Boyd, who had just marched Selma with Dr. King. He was the preacher. He worked within the confines of the Red Episcopal Hymnal at that time, but provided these kind of bossa nova settings to it. And then he kind of cooked all this up. Fantasy Records, his recording company, recorded all of it, released only part of it, and of course they've lost the rest of it. And a filmologist came in, you know, shot film of the whole event, but of course they don't know where that was.
Right.
And he had nothing but hassles from the cathedral staff, who now take credit for all this, but they at the time, you know, they had 20 people to a comp line service, and they said, well, we're not going to move our candles around for you people. So there's very limited time to kind of get everything set up. 2,000 people show up, and it's largely been lost. It, like I said, it has been recorded. And so 10 years ago, 2015, I thought, you know, we do an annual jazz service here on Labor Day weekend. How can I find the music? I couldn't find it. The cathedral staff didn't have it. So a friend and I transcribed the whole thing. We listened to it. We wrote parts. We worked with choirs. We redid it in Grace Cathedral in August of 2015. And 2 weeks later, we did it in my church in northeastern Pennsylvania with the choir. Mm-hmm. And people love it. And it's, again, never been published. And it has a lot of musical similarities to the music of Charlie Brown Christmas, which came out in the fall of, well, in December of 1965.
Huh.
Because they, and again, that part of that's in the book, and part of it's in Garaldi's biography by my friend Derek Fang, tells the fuller story and tells my story related to that as well. And that almost didn't air too, because Coca-Cola had a lot of issues with a Christmas special that was religious.
Ah, now that's funny.
Go figure.
I'll be.
Even in 1965.
Yeah. But
the soundtrack, to A Charlie Brown Christmas, is how a lot of kids first get turned on to jazz. Even when
I'm going to go off the script here for a moment.
Yeah.
And you've mentioned West Pennsylvania a couple times, and we're talking about jazz, and you're a Presbyterian minister. So if you don't know the answer to this, that's okay. But I figure if anyone's going to know this, you are. In a place that I don't associate with jazz, because, you know, my knowledge of the history of jazz is an amateur's at most. How did Fred Rogers end up with such a good jazz band for his show?
Oh, it's from Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's a hotbed of jazz music.
Was it really? Okay.
Absolutely. Okay. Earl Hines, Mary Lou Williams.
Okay.
Who else? Billy Strayhorn, Ellington's right-hand man. Composer.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. These are all the names that I know, but I don't associate them with, I usually associate them with New York City, not with Pittsburgh.
Errol Garner was from Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And those fleet-fingered pianists like Errol Garner,
yes,
just like Fred Rogers had his own fleet thing. You know, Johnny Costa was his fleet-fingered pianist. And I remember watching the show as a kid, and he would have jazz musicians on it. He had Wynton Marsalis on one episode.
Oh yeah, yeah.
His big afro, you know.
That was my introduction to jazz as a kid.
Yeah, and his handyman Negri, Joe Negri, who's I believe still with us in his 90s, he composed the jazz mass in the Catholic tradition. Plays great jazz guitar. He's still cooking it up out there.
I'll be.
Unbelievable. Again, jazz didn't emerge just only from New Orleans. It kind of came candelabra while from a lot of different flames.
Well, like I said, I mean, that is 100% a function of my spotty history, because I kind of know New Orleans, and I kind of know Memphis, and I kind of know Chicago and New York. But Pittsburgh, I hadn't really thought about. So
unbelievable. and they were largely African Americans, part of the Great Migration from the South, coming north for employment and then entertainment.
Well, there you go. Well, Bill, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about jazz, spirituality, Charlie Parker, or whatever else as we head for the door?
I would say give it a listen. If you haven't, give it a listen. And there are a lot of entry-level places. I mean, there's kind of the more popular jazz. I mean, if the last generation, it was Chuck Mangione, for instance, highly melodic music that really does touch the heart. But it's always a portal into the deeper tradition. George Benson was hot when I was a teenager. Find out he used to play with organ trios and still can burn it up. It's not just pop music. It's that there's more to the tradition and often gets dismissed. And given our current climate in the nation these days, I would follow the lead of Lyle Mays, who is the pianist and keyboardist for the Pat Metheny Group for many years. In one of his essays, he said that creating beauty is the greatest way to protest the ugliness that's around us. I'd leave you with that.
Now, Carter, thanks for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you.
Okay. Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is Thriving on a Riff from Broadleaf Books. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.